Hello, everyone, and happy holidays. Merry Christmas. I love Christmas. I love Thomas Jefferson. I love working with David Swensen. It's a great, difficult, strenuous time of the year, but for all of that, I love the idea of Christmas. And
do you want to apologize for Mr. Jefferson now, or I should let what stand at it was at the beginning of the show? I mean,
you know, Jefferson is essentially Ebenezer Jefferson.
He only did two holidays, and Christmas wasn't one of them.
He's all snotty about it. You know, like, you can't really tell me that Jesus was born on the 25th of December. And
well, there are those fun stories about his youth, and I believe that.
Yeah, I mean, there are beautiful sides to this story, and you know, actually, I have to say the best Christmas of my life. I was in Oxford. I was away from my family. I missed them terribly. You know, sometimes you have to throw something into relief to understand its importance.
Mm-hmm.
When I finally called home from that professor's house and finally got through and my father answered, back in Dickinson, North Dakota, across the Atlantic, across America, and there they were. I knew they missed me. And my father answered, and I just burst into tears, and I thought, where'd that come from?
Was that your first Christmas away from home?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, that's where it came from.
And my father loved Christmas more than anything in the world. And so for him, Christmas was it, fruitcake. And he would putting up the lights on the trees would take hours, and he'd make us all squint and, you know, is it balanced, and eggnog, and he loved Christmas. He just loved it. We had one fire in the fireplace every year, and of course he was just a dork, and so it would smoke up the house. All the alarm bells would go off. We'd have to open all the doors at 22 below to air out the thing, but then the fire would start. And he just loved it, and so it was hard not to love it on his behalf.
We hope you enjoy this show. It's Christmases with Jefferson from the past, and I'll also say that we're next week planning to do a retrospective, some of the favorite bits from the shows of
looking back over the year,
right, of 2016, as a way of looking towards 2017.
And then, my friend, I have been asked somewhat pointedly by fans around the country.
Uh-huh.
Are you just leaving Jefferson as Secretary of State? I mean, are you ever going to finish 101?
Oh, yeah,
we're ever going to get on with that?
You know, so many things happened in this past year that we kind of got sidetracked, but I know from what you have said, and I will agree wholeheartedly, it is very important to continue that series, and we will.
The best is yet to come,
yep.
So we have to get back into that experience and look for growth and joy in the Jefferson Hour in the next year.
Yes.
We so very much appreciate our listeners, and let me say this last piece. Now more than ever, the election of 2016 has been, no matter how you voted, has been one of the shocking moments of recent American history. And it has really stirred people up and given people anxiety and given people hope and fear. It's just, we're all stirred up. And I think if ever we have needed a safe place for rational discourse, that time is now. And people tell me everywhere I go that the Jefferson Hour is a refuge for them of complete English sentences and civil conversations, and the friendship between us matters. They can hear it through the radio. They love you. They don't know what you look like. You never show up.
Yeah.
But there is a... I think now more than ever, the Jefferson Hour feels to me like a life vest for me, as well as I think for many of our listeners. So thank you, everyone. And as Tiny Tim says, God bless us, everyone. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, brought to you by Bismarck State College on the banks of the Missouri River, at the heart of the Lewis and Clark Trail.
And good day, citizens. Welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, and a happy Christmas to all of you. Seated across from me now is the gentleman who created the Thomas Jefferson Hour, the award-winning humanities scholar and author Clay Jenkinson. And Clay, it's time for the annual Thomas Jefferson Christmas Show.
And I always feel like Ebenezer Jefferson on this occasion. Jefferson was a rationalist. He did not think that Christmas was a very big deal. Of course, Christmas wasn't a very big deal back then. Christmas is a very modern German and American invention. And Jefferson often traveled on Christmas, and he wrote letters on Christmas. And he of course, will point out that the 25th of December is an arbitrary day, that it has absolutely nothing to do with the historical Jesus, et cetera, et cetera. And so whenever we do this program, I always think, what a killjoy, what a buzzkill Mr. Jefferson is.
Don't give away too much. I do want to say that you will be in Rome when this show broadcasts.
And, yes.
That might be an interesting Christmas.
I'm taking my recording device and a brand new microphone you forced me to buy.
I was going to ask.
It came in the mail yesterday.
Yeah, great.
And so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to the Pantheon, the greatest of all buildings in Rome. My daughter will actually be with me.
Oh,
for part of the time.
Wonderful.
So she will.
Would you greet her for me and the Jefferson Hour listeners?
Wherever I go, people say, we enjoyed your daughter.
Yes, I know.
She was tough on you, sir. We had a great time, and so she will be with me, and I'm going to take this spectacular new microphone and some SD cards and some batteries, because these things eat batteries the way you and I eat jelly beans. And then we're going to do this there, and then I'll send it to you, and we'll have the Rome Jefferson wished he had visited.
Oh, yes. Program. There's so many things you can ask. But before we go to the show, I want to remind people it's that time of the year. If you'd like to support the Thomas Jefferson Hour, you can make a tax-deductible donation. Go to jeffersonhour.com for details. And we have some very special gifts for folks that would like to donate to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, involving some long-lost copies of Becoming Jefferson's People. Go to jeffersonhour.com for more details.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar, author, and creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. But seated across from me now is President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson, it's the end of the year, and I'm so pleased to be here with you today. I thought perhaps we could talk about the season, the holiday season, and you could let your listeners know how you think they should celebrate the holidays at this time of year.
As you know, I always disappoint when we have this conversation because I think everyone knows that I'm a skeptic and a deist, and therefore, I am not convinced that Jesus was the Son of God, and I am even less certain that Jesus was born on the 25th of December. It's a saint's day in the Catholic tradition, St. Michael's Day, St. Catherine's Day, St. Stephen's Day, and Christ's Day, and the Christian birthday on the 25th of December is artificially located there because it happened to coincide with the Saturnalia festivals of ancient Rome, and also a Mithraic cult that existed in the Roman Empire. And Mithraeus, who was a Persian cult figure, is said to have been born on the 25th of December. So as a rationalist, I had a hard time finding much reason to celebrate the Christmas holiday.
I know this, sir. And so I bring the subject up for conversation with that in mind. This is not something that you just dabbled. You held this belief late into your life.
Yes.
I found a letter that you wrote to John Adams in 1823 in which you wrote, "The day will come when the mystical generation of Jesus, by the Supreme Being as his father in the womb of a virgin, will be classed with the fable of the generation of Minerva in the brain of Jupiter."
Minerva, of course, is Athena, and Jupiter is Zeus. But the ancient myth is that Athena had no mother, that she was born out of the thigh or out of the brain of her father Zeus, that it was an immaculate conception.
It may help you to know, Mr. Jefferson, that Christmas has little to do with religion in American society anymore. It's mostly a commercial holiday, but it also is a time for families to get together. And
well, let me put it this way, sir. Every autumn, we have reason to celebrate the harvest.
Of course.
The bounty of the world, particularly the bounty of America.
You and I would agree, sir, that harvest festival is one of the best of the year.
Of course, because it celebrates something that comes from nature with a capital N. And it's a time of relief. You know, the harvest work is hard. The agricultural season is tedious and laborious and physically exhausting, and suddenly it's over for the year, and the ground has gone fallow. This is when you repair fences and gather your seeds for next year and rethink the shape or orderliness of your garden and sell your crops at market and so on. So this is a time of rest, and it's the time of the year when the light is the smallest. The shortest day of the year is the 21st of December. We all understand this. And therefore, it's a period of rest and recuperation. So I'm all for that, of course. And if your Christmas celebrates family and bringing scattered peoples together to enjoy the hearth and each other's company and to make special food for the occasion and perhaps to have a special drink that is either a family tradition or a Christmas tradition, all of that seems outstanding to me, and I wholly approve of it. But if you are saying that Jesus was born in a manger on the 25th of December, I have no quarrel with that, but I choose personally not to observe that holiday.
Could we perhaps, sir, as we've done in past years at this on this subject, we've talked about some of your more memorable Christmases.
When I was a young man, I spent the Christmas holidays at another plantation, the plantation of a friend of mine in another part of Virginia. And my room was up in the attic. The house was full.
Oh, yes.
And I slept under the rafters up in the attic. And at this time, I was in love with a woman named Rebecca Burrell, this beautiful young woman from a plantation in Virginia. And I was so enamored of her that I couldn't think straight. And I had gotten from her a silhouette. You know, we didn't have photographs in my time, and so when a young man was enamored of a woman, he would ask to have a drawing of her or a silhouette or some likeness of her that he could then cherish and look at in times of absence. And she had graciously enabled me to have an image of her. And I had put it in my watch case. These were pocket watches, and so it was in my watch case. And so I was put up in this attic where I was sleeping, and during the night it rained. And the rain came in, and unfortunately, where it dripped through the ceiling was right onto my watch, and it spoiled the watch, which was neither here nor there, although timepieces were new and expensive at the time. But it also tore or so waterlogged the silhouette that when I tried to extricate it, I tore it. And I then quoted from the Aeneid in Latin and made a huge hyperdramatic or melodramatic sort of business out of it, that would she forgive me for tearing her person in this way and so on and so forth. Well, that's probably the least interesting part of it to your era, this young infatuated man mooning over a woman that, by the way, eventually married someone else. But I also say in the same letter, almost offhand, that in the night rats came and took my garters and some of my pieces of music. So imagine an era when a young gentleman of sort of the highest social class could be routinely talking about rats rolling around in his bedroom, stealing his garters and stealing sheets of music and carrying them off into their lair.
I apologize for laughing. Certainly it was not humorous at the time.
It didn't particularly bother me, the rats. I mean, we lived with a level of connection to nature that – would probably give people of your era a nervous breakdown. That
certainly
didn't strike me as odd at all, but I was very concerned about this image of Rebecca Burl.
And how old were you?
I was 16 or so.
And you were traveling to –
William and Mary back to Charlottesville. But when one would go on a holiday like this, you'd spend 2, 3, 4 weeks. I mean, there were no overnight holidays of any sort in this era. People made extended stays.
Because of the difficulty of travel?
Difficulty of travel. There were no hotels. But, you know, the pace of life.
Of course, you're sleeping in attics with rats. Or
I once traveled to Poplar Forest with several of my granddaughters. We stayed at what passed for an inn. The sheets were vacated. You know, there were no inns of the sort that you think of in your time. The proprietors actually vacated their bed to enable us to have it. The sheets hadn't been changed for months, if not years. So imagine the filth. My point is that things that you take for granted, that everything is clean and usually sterile, that you can count on being the only person ever to have slept in a bed if you go to a hotel, these things didn't exist in my time. And actually, when I traveled sometimes, even as the president of the United States between Charlottesville and Washington, I would stop at an inn or a house and they'd say, well, Mr. Jefferson, welcome. Unfortunately, you're going to have to sleep with this stranger from Florida tonight. And he and I would sleep in the same bed because you have one or two choices. If you want to sleep in a bed, you share it. If you don't want to share it, you sleep on the floor. And so this was just the world that we lived in.
Well, Mr. President, I feel as if I've led our conversation astray a bit. I asked you for some Christmas memories, and I've gotten a couple of what we would call horror stories.
Well,
could we go back to the celebration itself?
So I'm at this country house, and there are young women, and there are young men, and there are hosts and adults, and outstanding hospitality. You know, Christmas then, as now, meant lots of food.
Mm-hmm.
And sweetmeats, you know, mm-hmm. special desserts and pies and things that you don't cook any other time in the year were there, and nogs and all sorts of concoctions of different sorts of alcohol.
You're listening to a special Christmas broadcast of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. And this week we're getting some Christmas memories from you, Mr. President. And I did some more reading about Christmas during your time, and I came across something that I did not know about, a Christmas that you had in 1805.
I was president.
And according to what I've read, there were 6 of your grandchildren and 100 other friends. This was put together by James Madison's wife, Dolly.
Yes.
Do you recall this? Could you share any information about it?
Well, I was a widower. My wife, Martha, had been dead for a very long time, since 1782, and the family tradition is that on her deathbed, I vowed never to remarry. So from 1782 until 1826, I was a grieving widower, and therefore, I lived alone in the White House, and my daughter Maria was actually very concerned about this, and she would write me and say, Papa, I worry about you in that cold and drafty place alone with Meriwether Lewis, and you know, you should take better care of yourself. It's so drafty, and the fireplaces are inadequate, and you know, the way that a daughter feels solicitude for her. She saw me as elderly. I was in my 60s then. Father, and felt that I was incapable of living as a bachelor. Of course, I had been mastering this life for a very long time. And twice during my presidency, one or both of my daughters came up to Washington, D.C. And on the first instance, I couldn't get them myself, so Meriwether Lewis went out and met them partway. He was still living with me as my aide-de-camp, and then he brought them into the city, and he helped to run errands for them. They needed new clothing to be fashionable, and they knew new wigs and you know, all the things that a woman needs to be presented to society. And so on one of the occasions, my daughter Martha brought several of my grandchildren with her, including Jeff, my favorite of my grandsons. And he actually disappeared one day. Got lost, and his mother panicked. Well, he was actually found at the Naval Yard where he was being entertained by officers of the Navy. They knew who he was, and so they were taking good care of him. But they had produced a kind of concoction for him. It wasn't an alcoholic drink, but it was sort of a what you would call a kind of a Roy Rogers or a Shirley Temple. You know, it was made to feel like an adult drink, but it was harmless. Oh, his mother was angry at him and wanted to punish him severely, and I forced her to forgive him. A young boy in a great city being entertained by naval officers and seeing a world that he had never expected to see in his whole life. But our Christmases were not in Washington, D.C. I would make my way home to Monticello for Christmas, and we often had splendid gatherings there. You know, Dolly Madison and her husband, James Madison, my closest friend, lived just 30 miles away, and so we often spent these holidays together. Congress was in recess. We always wanted, of course, to get back to our beloved Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia. We would exchange visits. I would go to Montpelier more often. James and his wife, Dolly Madison, would come to Monticello, and my grandchildren and daughters would.
What I found interesting about it, Mr. President, was that it sounded like such a festive affair. There's written accounts of it. As you say, Dolly Madison was the official hostess.
Very effusive woman. She was a big, buxom, happy, charismatic woman.
Probably looking out for you and your well-being. And
always took care of me because she knew I was a lonely old man.
Right. But it sounds like it was a marvelous affair. In fact, there's written accounts of you playing fiddle, which at that time of your life must have been difficult.
I hadn't done it for many years, as you know. When I was a young man, between the ages of, say, 15 and 30, I was a serious fiddler and practiced several hours per day, often up to 3 hours per day, and became a pretty serious musician. I had three fiddles, a very fine one, a good one, and then a kit. I don't know if you know what a kit is.
It's smaller,
like a ukulele. It's tiny. It's a traveling fiddle. It's called a kit or mm-hmm. It's a diminutive. So I had three. One of them I spent a fortune on, and I was regarded by others as a fine violinist. I would not, of course, say that of myself. But then when I was in Europe, I fell in love for the last time with a woman named Maria Cosway. My wife had been dead now for many years. I did not expect ever to let my heart dilate again. But I met a painter and a musician and a composer named Maria Cosway, who was one of the most beautiful women in Europe. And she was a famous coquette, you know, by which I mean she was the kind of woman who makes men fall in love with her. This was her hobby, and they did routinely. I mean, hundreds of men fell in love with Mrs. Cosway, and I was just one of them. But what changed everything is that she in turn then fell in love with me, which produced a somewhat awkward situation because she was married. In other words, there was a marriage of convenience, and her husband knew that this was what she did. She attached all these men to her, but she played with them. She toyed with men. And suddenly she lost her heart to me, and so it never became a problem. And we observed all the proprieties, of course, but we were romantic friends. And she and I wandered about Paris for about a month together, sometimes with her husband, sometimes not. We were all friends, and he completely understood the nature of the friendship between us and approved of it. But one day, I've never really divulged all the details, and I'm not going to now, but I attempted to jump over a fence to impress her or to catch up with her or you know how one behaves when one is enamored. And I tripped and broke my right wrist. And it was very badly misplaced. I couldn't move it. It stiffened terribly. And at that time, surgeons were barbers and barbers were surgeons. And so I went, because it was regarded as a, it was not regarded as a medical art. It was regarded in a certain sort of way as chiropractic, you know. So I went to a barber and he tried to set the hand and he failed. And I never actually gained full use of that hand again. It was always stiff. I could write with it. But I stopped playing the violin then because I didn't have the dexterity that one really needs for.
And yet at this Christmas party.
I was persuaded it's probably by Dolly Madison.
And you played for dancing children.
I could do it.
This is a vision I have in my head of this occurrence.
But I would never have done this outside of the confines of my closest friends.
Oh, but sir, it was Christmas.
It was Christmas. But I was very, you know, I think you know about me that I don't do anything unless I do it masterfully.
Well, I'm beginning to suspect about you, sir, that there is a side of you that only does things masterfully. But at the same time, you were a grandfather. It was Christmas, and you allowed yourself to enjoy the moment.
I hope you're not suggesting that I had become lightened by imbibing alcohol.
Oh, certainly not, sir. I would know
a glass
than
or
that.
Two of wine, perhaps.
Water.
But of course, around one's children and grandchildren. And I once said that a grandchild can make you get down on your hands and knees and play horsey. You know, a president of the United States. Nothing else could have gotten me onto my knees, but a grandchild has a way of cutting through all of one's sense of dignity.
Right.
And restoring the joy of life that you have unfortunately abandoned.
And isn't it a wonderful thing, sir?
Of course. And I'm happiest with my daughters and my grandchildren and my gardens and my books and my scientific instruments and my friends like Madison or Monroe and my own hearth. That's why we exist on Earth. And ideally, there would be no governments. There'd be no public life. We would all just be individuals scattered everywhere and living good lives.
And for that moment, that day, you were. You know, I think about I've been privileged to see your home. It's been preserved. And I think about that house with 100 and some guests and tables of food and music and dancing and laughter. It must have been wonderful, sir.
You can have no idea of the abundance, even though I was essentially bankrupt. But if you were a guest at Monticello for the Christmas holidays, there'd be no rats in your room, I can tell you that.
And clean sheets?
We had bricks, clean sheets, and everything was spotless. Everything was done to the absolute best tradition. And the food would come out in elegance and in abundance, and there would be candles. And all the music was live, and so we wouldn't have music while we ate. But afterwards, I would say to my daughter, Martha, perhaps you could play a tune on the pianoforte or the harpsichord, or some young man who was courting one of the granddaughters would play his violin, and there'd be duets.
Would there be singing of songs reflecting the season, sir?
Almost never. You know, there might be in the course of – we would attend Anglican services.
Mm-hmm.
I always fulfilled the proprieties. My children were baptized. They were confirmed. Weddings often occurred with.
So you didn't force your beliefs on your children?
Oh, no, certainly not. And I believe in public,
well done, sir. Well
public
done.
Observance of modest and rational religious activity is not detrimental to one's conscience. In other words, I was not an atheist. I was not someone who would sneer.
Brings communities together and comforts people.
And people come together in the village square and greet each other and shake hands and say Merry Christmas to you and Happy Holidays, and all these things are harmless, unless you ask me to believe them. That's another question. So, if you came to Monticello, you would go away saying, I may have happier times in my life, but I will never be treated with greater hospitality than I have been for these 10 days.
Excellent.
The food, outstanding. The wine, world class. The walks, the gardens, the tidiness, the salon conversations, the musicales.
What about the weather, sir? You know, where I live, it's deathly cold at this time of year. What's Virginia like in December?
Well, I know you live on the plains of upper Louisiana, and I know something about that from my protege, Mary Weather Lewis.
Please, you're not going to insult my home, are you?
I'm going to say that when it was 35 or 20 degrees at Monticello, I would have regarded that as almost appallingly cold. So imagine if I had come with Lewis.
Well, it does take a certain type of constitution to absorb that.
But, you know, we had wool and blankets, and we had slaves that would keep us warm and light fires. And you know, we made sure we were comfortable. And when you went in, there was eggnog, or there was a hot toddy, or there was brandy, or hot chocolate. You know, we understood comfort. And in a certain sense, every day was Christmas at Monticello, because I made sure that there was always abundance, that everyone felt welcome, and that there was a kind of a festive quality to being a part of the larger circle at Monticello. But at Christmas, we would have added a few things. We didn't do Christmas trees. That's a German tradition that came later.
No Christmas stockings hung?
No stockings. We might have exchanged a gift, a small gift of some sort. You know, in our day, Christmas was still in the Anglican tradition. It's very different in New England, very different in amongst the Dutch or the Germans. But in the Anglican tradition, Christmas was still in some sense tied to the old Saturnalia of ancient Rome. It sort of comes towards your Halloween of trick or treat. In the Saturnalia, the masters served the servants, and the servants could play tricks on the masters, and the masters had to give the servants gifts. There was a kind of a topsy-turviness, a changing of the social order for that one little period. And so when we would give gifts at Christmas, we would give gifts to the servants and the slaves, because this was the one time of year that the traditional hierarchy was reversed.
You followed this practice at Monticello?
Yes, not with all the slaves, of course, but with overseers. And so once in a while there would be a gift exchange, not every year. You know, I often traveled on Christmas. I wrote letters on Christmas. I read books on Christmas.
You brought up slaves a couple of times, and I feel that it's all right to ask you
about
that. What became of the average slave at Monticello, not the ones who lived or worked in the house, but the others? Did they get time off? Did they get special food? Did they get anything?
They would have had time off because the harvest season is over. And so during the darkest days, you know, this is, as I said before, this is during the darkest time of the year. We lived in daylight. We had no artificial light. Only very wealthy people had light.
For some of those slaves, it was a dark time all year.
But in the summer, you have 13, 14 hours of light,
right?
15 sometimes. In the winter, 6 or 7 at times of effective light. And so the slaves would have rested from the rigors of the harvest. They had African traditions that I don't know the first thing about, although my daughter studied some of that, but it wouldn't be Christmas, of course.
I would love to think that someone there saw to it that they got an extra portion of this or
– Oh, of course. We – at the Christmas period, let me think of it in a secular way. We knew it was Christmas. We knew it was Saturnalia. We knew it was the end of the year. We knew it was a downtime on the farm. So a little extra pork, maybe their issue of clothing for the new year, some time off, some gifts maybe to favorite household slaves, a small – piece of ribbon or, you know, a new dress or, you know, something. But mostly the slaves would have felt that they had free time, because although some of them worked, household slaves and cooks and shepherds and people watching flocks, people curing tobacco, it was nothing like what life was like in September or in June or during the planting season. And so this was the one time of year when I don't know what they were doing because I didn't make it my business, but they were frolicking and enjoying a period when the demands on them were much lower than they would have been routinely.
If you had one favorite Christmas memory, Mr. President, is that a fair question to ask?
It's a fair question to ask, but it's not a very useful question to ask me. I suppose this story that I told about Rebecca Burrell, we remember the Christmases of our youth.
Do you look back with humor now?
Well, with embarrassment that I wanted so much to marry her.
You were a young man, though.
You know, she was my first love, and I actually decided the following spring to propose to her. And I worked up a speech, memorized it. I was so shy, you can hardly even, you wouldn't have been able to recognize me. And I was tall and awkward, and my limbs were too long, and my clothes were too small, and I was a country bumpkin. I mean, I was not somebody, I was from a farm, and she was much more sophisticated and mature than I was, and just so beautiful that I trembled in her presence. And I worked up this speech, and it was at the Apollo Room of the Raleigh Tavern when I finally decided to propose to her, and we were dancing the minuet, which is not an intimate dance. And so you have to wait for your moments when you can even talk. And finally, this moment came, and I realized it was now or never. And so I opened my mouth to deliver this proposal, and a few broken words came out of my mouth, ungrammatical and punctuated by pauses of uncommon length. And I stammered and sweated and looked down at the ground and finally finished it and withdrew, and then realized to my horror that it was certainly possible that she hadn't understood a single word of what I'd said, and certainly not its intention. That was one of the hardest days of my life, and I swore off love after that and decided to be a lifelong bachelor. And she soon became engaged to somebody else and married him. And it was – but that – you know, when you're in love and it hasn't yet gone sour, that Christmas when I was – we were corresponding, and I was flirting with her through others and asking her, you know, what does she think of me and does she know about this, and, you know, the way teenagers are, but all done by letter. And just aching for her in an attic with rats walking over my head.
Let me take those you
are
away
Christmases.
From that.
No, but there's a certain kind of beauty in how pathetic one is.
Mr. President, we need to end this part of our conversation now. Before we do, I certainly would not ask you to wish your listeners Merry Christmas, but perhaps you could wish them good times with their families and enjoying the season. Would that be all right, sir?
Yes, may your Saturnalia be characterized by abundance and good conversation.
I thank you very much, Mr. Jefferson.
You're so kind.
We'll be back in just a moment, and when we return, we'll be speaking with the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Also, your weekly conversation with the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. And I'm running through titles for this program as we speak of the Bah Humbug.
Scrooge Does Christmas. I've always loved the Christmas program that we do because it turns out Jefferson is such a downer on Christmas.
This year we've strategically placed this show to be heard several days after Christmas. We won't ruin anybody's.
It's really interesting because there are two things that are going on at this. Well, three things. One is Christmas hasn't really been invented yet. Christmas is not an ancient tradition. It's really a 19th century tradition. And it largely comes from Germany. That's where we get Tannenbaum and the Yule log and the Christmas tree and much of the lights and the candles and so on. A lot of it is really a Germanic holiday from the forests, these forest dwellers of Germany. The Puritans, who basically created the United States, New England, the Puritans were so much worse than Jefferson, if you think he's a downer.
Every time.
They banished Christmas.
It was against the law.
Christmas was against the law in New England until like the 1690s or something.
And people did go to jail.
Yeah, because it was an idolatrous day. Because right. just as the Puritans said, well, St. Stephen's Day, that's just a Catholic invention. I mean, we don't know when he was born. And St. Matthew's Day, that's just arbitrary. Jesus wasn't born on the 25th of December. We know that. And they knew that it tied to Saturnalia and Mithraic traditions. And
Saturnalia is really, I want to hear more about
really
that.
It's really interesting. Yeah. So the Puritans said, we're getting rid of absolutely everything that's not biblically based.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't want any stained glass windows.
The original war on Christmas.
No, it is. I mean, you talk about, you know, Bill O'Reilly has no idea. He should write a book on this, The Death of Christmas, because it's really not about modern materialism. It's about the Puritans. So the Puritans are really grim. They want to strip Christianity of everything that can't be found in a biblical text.
Yeah. If you don't feel guilty, you're doing something
wrong.
And
so purgatory goes,
right.
and indulgences go, and uh-huh. stained glass windows go, and vestments, and so on and so forth. So all the saints' days. So the last saints' day that is secularly addressed in the world is Christmas. And so they banished it by law. Well, the Anglicans were always less nutty than the Puritans.
Rigid, perhaps, would be a better word.
And they had modest Christmas observings, but mm-hmm. it was so low-key mm-hmm. that not much happened. But, I mean, there would be Anglican services and so on, candle lighting and so on, some carols. Jefferson is the third wing of this because he is an Enlightenment rationalist skeptic. So he's not against it the way the Puritans are. He just regards it as beneath human reason. So he frequently chose to travel on Christmas because he thought, great travel day. Everyone else is doing stuff. And he writes letters and reading books and doing projects.
Actually, it is pretty – myself and my family spent a Christmas holiday in Washington, D.C. Great time
to go. It's a great time. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's great time. So Jefferson
Nobody's
is not –
there.
You know,
yeah.
If you were interviewing Charles Dickens, now you'd have something on Christmas. But see, what the problem is that we see the world through our lens.
Uh-huh.
So today, when I was growing up, you tell me we're about the same age. When I was growing up, Jesus still was the reason for the season. I mean, Christmas was a pretty religious holiday
world. It was starting to bend, though.
We had gifts,
yeah.
but it wasn't crazy yet. Sometime in the last 15 or 20 years, American culture effectively jettisoned the Christian side
of
Christmas.
I said to President Jefferson, I said Christmas now has little to do with religion.
You're absolutely right.
And you know, there may be people that are offended by that.
Well, no, but plenty – I mean Christians do observe Christmas and wonderfully.
Yeah,
but
yes.
But in terms of an American event,
yeah.
you know, a quarter of all merchandise is purchased for Christmas.
Right.
Think of that. A quarter of all merchandise.
Yeah, you talk about our generation, kind of the last vestiges of it not being as consumer nuts as it. Think of the children that are growing up now and where it's going to go. Maybe there'll be a backlash.
I think there will. I think, you know, you can't sustain this level of consumer capitalism uh-huh. endlessly. And I think people like your son and my daughter are I won't say offended by it, but they're less enamored of it.
My son's offended by it.
So
no doubt about it.
We'll see what happens. But anyway, Jefferson's not your guy. On the other hand, it's fascinating. That Christmas trip that he had where he met Patrick Henry, that had to be some holiday.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had one of these. When I was in England, I didn't come back because it was very expensive and I'd made a pact with myself to spend – if I were going to go to Oxford, I'm going to stay there. So I did not come home and it was pretty sad in a way. But
and you would have been 20
– 22 or 3, maybe 4. And so this family invited me to come out and spend Christmas with them. I had kind of met them. They were uh-huh. they were just a farm family from Oxford.
Worried about this poor, lonely American
and they,
boy.
They belonged to something called the Raleigh Club, and they would take in Canadians. And I had a Canadian girlfriend, and she introduced me to them. They said, oh, well, come spend the holidays with us. So I went out there. They picked me up at a pub in Oxford, and we went out, and I spent 2 weeks with them. And I wouldn't say this in front of my mother, but it was maybe my happiest Christmas ever. These people, they were the name the Dickinsons, and they were completely broke, but they had a huge
Victorian or even earlier house at three stories and no central heat. So they would like, I'd go to bed and they'd put like 12 blankets on me because you were just freezing to death.
Uh-huh.
And they were not alcoholics, but they drank every minute. So you'd get up at 9 in the morning and they start pouring wine for you. And, you know, you're drunk 3 or 4 times in a single day. And we would go for these long walks and then she would make these pâtés and these pies. And they had what's called an auger, this oven that's always hot. So they'd have one for soup and one for bread and they would have stews and these roasts and peacocks and turkeys. And you have no idea. And so it was just exactly what I think of with Jefferson. It was so filled with love.
Uh-huh.
And so festive. And then we, on Christmas Eve, we went to an Anglican church and like no one goes to Anglican churches. They're empty most of the year. But on Christmas Eve, everyone goes. It's like uh-huh. here. And so we're there in this Anglican church and it's dark outside and crisp. And then we go to the pub and have 7 or 8 drinks at the pub and back to their place and there's soup. At 2 in the morning, you wander down to the kitchen and there are 3 or 4 other people there eating, you know, pieces of turkey and we played cards and we played chess and we played what they call charades and we had literary contests and I read to them from Laura Ingalls Wilder and they thought, what the hell? Some farm thing in the prairie. And, you know, but it was fantastic because it was filled with love and not gifts.
Uh-huh.
And so I got them some little gift, like a bottle of brandy or something as a thanks. And then it's Christmas morning and around their tree, which is a real tree, they have the old bulbs, you know, the bulbs that were the size of a light bulb.
Uh-huh.
And so around the tree, there are like 15 people and there are about 18 gifts. You know, that's it. In America, there would have been 1,800 gifts.
Uh-huh.
And so, and they were kind of moving around. They hand me this gift. And I almost started to cry. I thought, well, I don't even know you. And they hand me this gift. So it's a beautiful book about the gardens of Oxfordshire or something. And I'm sure they just picked it up, you know, in passing, but it was so generous.
Uh-huh.
It was so generous. It was absolutely amazing. And it just strikes me that what made it so great is that it wasn't Target, Walmart, Amazon.com, Best Buy, rushing around, you know, kind of the nuttiness of consumer capitalism. It was really about festivalness. And I saw more love in that family than you see. I mean, Christmas is a very stressful time in the United States.
It can be.
For lots of people.
Yes.
And part of it is because, and this has been true for me almost all my life, and it is certainly now that I'm sending my daughter to a private liberal arts college, there is not enough money to buy the stuff that you're kind of expected to buy for people.
Right.
If you can spend several thousand dollars buying gifts before you scratch the surface. Most people, you know, we all know that real incomes have plummeted since the Reagan Revolution. I'm not blaming him. And the average family doesn't have this kind of money sitting around, but you feel obligated to buy something nice for somebody. And so the stress on parents or the stress on whoever is the main breadwinner for the household of trying to figure out who's going to pay for all this. You know, it's really kind of crazy, the strain we put on. And so people spend 2, 3, 4 months in the spring trying to pay off this thing. And most Christmas gifts, I mean, very few Christmas gifts really ring the bell. Most Christmas gifts
are needed.
Well, certainly not needed.
Right.
Forget need. I'm talking about, I mean, and I remember one year, about 5 years ago, David, my daughter said to me, we're going to go to a Christmas wish tree. So I had a friend who went to a Methodist church and I asked and they brought me like 6 tags, you know, these paper tags that are – and it would be like you turn it over and it's like Jeremiah, age 7, wants coat or Judith, age 9, wants Barbie doll. So we picked 5 or 6 or 7 of these, and my daughter and I went shopping at Walmart or Target or something. The majority of them were for things that they needed, like socks, shirt, jacket, coat, you know, mittens. It just makes you want to cry to think of the poverty that exists in the midst of all this abundance and the need. And so we bought this stuff, and we spent probably $300 or $400 or $500 on this. It was the best $500 we ever spent, because in each case I would say, all right, this young man wants a race car set. So we'd go to the area in Walmart or whatever where the race car sets were, and then we'd have this debate, and I'd say, how about this one? My daughter would say, oh, no, it has to be this. And so there'd be like a person we were never going to meet. They don't tell you who the gift is from. You know, this is anonymous. We're never going to meet this person. My daughter would say, no, I think she wants a white coat, Dad. Okay. You know, if you say so. So,
well, you know, really,
it was so beautiful. It was so beautiful. It was more meaningful than anything.
What you're saying is, what is that old adage, is that it's better to give than receive.
But it's better to give to somebody who can actually need and appreciate it. You know,
right.
When I give to my mother's 83, I'm almost 60. This year we're not giving each other anything. We're going on a trip in January. That's our gift. But if I give her something, it's like, can I think of something that she doesn't have, that she wouldn't have already bought for herself, that she will really want, that isn't just going to gunk up her house? You know, it's so hard. At this point, she's got everything she wants and she never waits. If she wants it, she gets it. So I think of something, and then she, for me, like, you know, what am I going to get him? He's got a garage full of stuff he doesn't now use.
Maybe a book.
A book. So we get each other things that we can read, because we know it. We're going to love books. But, you know, so for us, it's like we have to do creative thinking to find a gift to give to each other that we don't need, period. And then there are, in Bismarck alone, a town of about 100,000, there are probably 5,000 to 10,000 people who can't afford to give their children even minimal Christmas gifts, who would if they could, but they can't. And to think that we live in a culture where we can just kind of shrug that off and then buy gifts that people don't need for money that we can,
well,
that's ridiculous.
It's pretty easy to give it up. And, you know, speaking as one
your family lives very modestly at Christmas.
Well, we pretty much bailed on that whole Christmas thing 5, 6, 7 years ago. And it's not that hard to do, and it's such a relief. That's not to say we don't, you know, celebrate and get together with friends.
Of course.
But all of the expected American trappings we've sort of given up. But before we run out of time, if I might.
Yes, sir.
Unless there was something essential you needed to add to this. You just got back from Rome.
From Rome.
And I was hoping that you would agree to perhaps do a show about that trip in the next week or so.
Let's do it on this basis. I have lots to say about Rome. I spent 3 weeks there teaching a capstone course for a liberal arts Catholic university. Amazing. But it also reminds me that Jefferson, our man Jefferson, in 1787 left Paris and went on this tour of southern France, and he then got to the Alps, and he wanted so much to do the grand tour, which is to go to Naples and Rome.
But he didn't, did he?
He didn't. He went as far as Milan.
Uh-huh.
And he has actually very grumpy things to say about the cathedral. He's so utilitarian.
The 600-year construction project?
He talks about the vanity of human waste and, you know, Jefferson. But he kept his journal, and he spent 2 days learning how to make Parmesan cheese. That was more important to him than, you know. So
I get that.
I get that.
Yeah.
So, and he brought the recipe back, of course. But he then, you could just tell he so wanted to go to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
It's because they were Roman more than Greek. Founding fathers were like deep into the Roman Republic. But his sense of duty was such that he turned back. He said, I had a peep into Elysium. And I was at the Pantheon the other day. You know, the Pantheon is one of the world's top 5 buildings. It's in the center of Rome. You know, for me, it's Parthenon and then the Pantheon, and it goes down from there. So I'm sitting at the Pantheon, this building that existed at the time of Hadrian. It's from 125 AD. And Jefferson's rotunda at UVA is based upon the Pantheon, which he never saw. And I just thought, what would he have felt if he could have sat here and looked at this building? It would have been one of the supreme moments of his life.
So let me ask you this. Should we have a conversation with Mr. Jefferson about Rome, or would you like to come to that conversation?
Well, maybe I do it, but I talk about Mr. J.
Okay, well, let's make it a date then in our next conversation.
Let's do it. It's kind of
Rome.
A New Year sort of thing.
In the minute or two that we have left, we've talked pretty grumpy about Christmas, but we haven't mentioned a Happy New Year to all of your listeners and how much I know we both appreciate the mail and the advice and comments we get from listeners. So
I go to, you know, I travel around the country, and everywhere I go, people say, "Say hello to David. Why doesn't he come with you?"
That's so nice.
It's true.
I don't get out much.
You don't, but they do say this, and then they say, you know, they witness how much they appreciate the Jefferson Hour, and you know, we get criticism and you know, blah blah blah. But most of what the feedback I get, especially when I travel, is deeply gratifying. And for me, I mean, this is going to sound a little cheesy, but this is the ultimate gift, mm-hmm. that I can sit here in a barn in the middle of North Dakota, in a manger, let's say, and I can speak across from you, and hundreds of thousands of people, if not more, listen because they say it's civil, it's thoughtful, it's well-informed, it's rational, it's what America was supposed to be, a place where we can talk about ideas without throwing things at each other.
That's pretty lofty.
I always blush, but when they say that, I always think, what a gift they're giving us, that week after week, people listen to us. And that makes me want to do it right, and I just want to say to everybody how much I appreciate you and how much the Jefferson Hour depends upon your listening. For David Swenson, I want to say Merry Christmas to all of us. Happy New Year. Keep listening, and God bless all of you. Merry Christmas.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.